The story behind the headlines. Every Sunday evening at this time, the National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with the American Historical Association, presents Caesar Searchinger in his analysis of the news. In this analysis, Mr. Searchinger draws upon research material especially prepared for these broadcasts by eminent historians. And now, Caesar Searchinger.
Good evening, everybody. Many of you, no doubt, heard Secretary Marshall's report on the London conference over this network on Friday night. A few hours earlier, President Truman had sent to Congress his historic message calling for the implementation of the long-range European recovery plan associated with Secretary Marshall's name. The two events are closely related. The London conference marks the end of one major operation in our foreign policy, and the Marshall Plan message marks the beginning of another. The London conference was the latest, and possibly for a long time the last, effort to make four-power collaboration a reality in building the peace of the world. It came at the end of a long period of growing doubt. This doubt must have been alive in the minds of some statesmen even at the time of the Potsdam Conference, from which all the other so-called peace conferences have sprung. It became more and more general in the long and arduous process of writing peace treaties for the satellite states and minor belligerents. It ripened into skepticism and disbelief with the failure of the Moscow Conference last spring, after Secretary Marshall had taken over from Secretary Burns. The Moscow Conference signalized a radical change in our political strategy, a change in which a course of action began to take precedence over a stream of words. The immediate outcome of that change was the development of the Marshall Plan for European economic recovery and the rallying of the nations of Western Europe to the support of that plan. The reaction to it on the part of Soviet Russia was the organization of the Cominform and the furtherance of strikes and unrest in Italy and France. These events were accompanied by a hardening of attitudes on both sides of the ideological fence. France, which had, up to the Moscow Conference, played a mediating role, became more and more identified with the Western Bloc, especially since Russia's refusal to endorse the Tsar going to France and the communist-inspired strikes. The Western powers went to London with little expectation of success. Our delegation pretty well foresaw what would happen, and that the Russians would again play for time and use the conference as a platform for propaganda, aimed this time at the Germans, since the unification of Germany was one of the main subjects to be discussed. The basic issue, Secretary Marshall said on Friday, was whether the Allies could agree among themselves to reunite Germany. If they could, the whole problem of European rehabilitation would be near a solution. The growing division of Europe into two potentially hostile camps would be arrested, and the principle of four-power collaboration might be saved. But unless the problem of unification was settled, all other questions about Germany would remain academic, and there was no use going on. The conference broke up, and the cleavage of Europe into East and West is an accepted fact. Since we cannot look forward to a unified Germany at this time, we must, in Secretary Marshall's words, do what we can in the area where our influence can be felt, namely Western Europe. That is the philosophy behind the abrupt termination of the London conference and the almost simultaneous publication of the administration's outline of the European Recovery Plan, or ERP. This plan is outlined in the president's message, is what the London Times calls it, a new page in American and world history. As an example of international economic planning, it is without precedent in magnitude and character. Its objective goes far beyond the usual concepts of economic aid to individual countries. It envisages the reconstruction of the major economic areas of a whole continent. It involves a degree of inter-European cooperation and integration unheard of in pre-war times, with incalculable possibilities for the future. By far the greater part of the materials involved are to originate in Europe itself. But the American contribution, foods, raw materials, machinery, etc., is to supply critical deficiencies which now prevent the full restoration of productive capacity. Actually, the United States plans to export no more than it has been exporting since the war. The difference is in the overall planning of the exports to ensure their most efficient use, with the aim of making the ERP countries self-supporting after 4 years. The cost in dollars is estimated to be less than 5% of what we spent in preparing and fighting the war. And the aim in the last analysis is to avoid the necessity of another costly war. The estimated amount, $17 billion over 4 years, is actually less than 3% of our national income. Some of the aid would be in the form of loans, most of it in grants. But the equivalent of these grants in the various national currencies must be used for constructive purposes and with our consent. Most of the money obviously will be spent here in the United States, where, barring proper safeguards, it will increase the dangers of inflation, and in other countries of the hemisphere. Indeed, Canada and the Latin American countries are expected to supply a large share of the foodstuffs and raw materials. It's important not to confuse this vast recovery action with relief. It isn't relief. The part played in it by the European countries is as important and even more difficult than ours. To qualify for participation, they must take action to balance their budgets, a very Spartan task right now, and to stabilize their currencies. They must utilize the available materials to the maximum efficiency and for the common benefit of the 16 countries. They must increase their production of consumers' goods and goods for export beyond the pre-war volume in accordance with the 16-nation Paris plan worked out last summer. They must also produce certain strategic materials for our stockpiling requirements. But it is impossible to give a complete picture of this vast project, which should be read in detail, especially by our legislators, who will have to act on it when they return to Washington after the Christmas holidays. There will be some opposition, of course. There may even be a substitute Republican plan. But as it stands, the plan represents 6 months' work and study by thousands of experts in over a dozen countries. It is the composite of the Paris 16 Nation Report and the reports of several committees in the United States, presidential, departmental, and congressional. It is influenced, of course, by considerations of enlightened self-interest and power, as well as the dictates of humanity. The course on which we are now embarking, Congress willing, is without precedent in our history. It is going to be a difficult road, the President warns, and full success cannot be guaranteed. We must reckon with active opposition in Eastern Europe, even with sabotage. We must realize that half of Europe is not actively with us, however regretfully, and that this half of Europe supplied most of the foodstuffs of Europe before the world wars. But no doors are being closed by us, and sheer economic necessity may yet force a measure of collaboration by states now in Russia's orbit, collaboration which may increase with time. At this solemn moment, it may be well to look back on the road which we leave. It all began with the Atlantic meeting of Churchill and Roosevelt in August 1941, and the Atlantic Charter, whose 8 points were accepted a few months later by 26 nations, including the Soviet Union, as the basic aims of peace. It is important to recall briefly what the Charter contains. For not only we and the British Commonwealth, but all the other Allies were committed to its principles. It says that the Allies seek no aggrandizement, territorial or other, that they desire no territorial changes that do not accord with the freely expressed wishes of the peoples concerned, that they respect the right of all peoples to choose their form of government, and that they will further the enjoyment of all by all states, great or small, victor or vanquished, of access on equal terms to the trade and the raw materials of the world. The Charter further pledges the fullest economic collaboration between all peoples, the disarmament of the aggressor nations, and the eventual abandonment of the use of force, pending the creation of a system of collective security. These were the avowed principles for which we went to war, and they have not been officially abrogated by any party to the pact. But it was clear almost from the start that the association with Russia was not on the same intimate character as that between the two Anglo-Saxon powers. There were no big three meetings in the first 20 months after Pearl Harbor, although an increasing flow of war materials went to Britain and Russia as well. Russia, indeed, was fighting for her very life, just as Britain had fought for survival in 1940 and 41. It was the United States and Britain who combined their strategy and decided the Allied landings in Africa. It was Roosevelt and Churchill who first agreed on that unconditional surrender, the dictum against any form of negotiated peace, though Russia is reaping the benefit of Germany's unconditional surrender right now. Not till October 1943 did the representatives of all three powers meet in Moscow to consider the further course of the war. Secretary Hull went to that conference filled with doubts and fears, but Stalin at last agreed to meet Roosevelt and Churchill at Tehran, and the Tehran Declaration of December 1, 1943 confirmed the Moscow agreements. It not only concerted the war plans of the Big Three against Germany, but it pledged them to join efforts for an enduring peace. This was 2 years after we and the Russians became joint belligerents. Another 14 months was to pass before the Big Three met again at Yalta and agreed on the unconditional surrender terms which Roosevelt and Churchill had decreed long before at Casablanca. Yalta was, therefore, the real beginning of the joint peace-building which has now gone on the rocks. At Yalta, the fatal agreement was made to occupy Germany in separate zones, first three and then, together with France, four. At Yalta, the main line of demarcation between east and west was already determined. At Yalta, too, the outlines of a Carthaginian peace for Germany were drawn, though it was left to the Potsdam Conference to fix details. The Yalta terms, drawn in the heat of conflict, were far from the principles of the Atlantic Charter, with its ban on territorial aggrandizement and its noble phrase about the freely expressed wishes of the peoples concerned. But most of the difficulties which we have now looked upon and which have led to a deadlock derive from the Potsdam Conference of the summer of 1945. Roosevelt had died. Churchill fell from power before the agreement was signed. Stalin alone was there from the beginning to the end. The change in personnel made things difficult for the Western powers. But the decisive factor was the defeat and unconditional surrender of Germany, which made Soviet Russia independent of her allies, while we were still in the midst of a vast and costly Pacific campaign. Potsdam confirmed the conditions of Yalta, but it slanted them even more in Russia's favor. It confirmed Russia and her present ally, Poland, in one of the greatest land accessions in all history. It gave Russia practically a veto power over all decisions affecting the future of the continent. At Potsdam, the Council of Foreign Ministers was entrusted with the drawing up of the peace treaties, and it has been at it ever since, that is to say, until the breakdown at London. The treaties with the satellites have not materially altered the extent of Russian control. Only agreement on the future of Germany could have resolved the deadlock and led to the establishment of a new balance in Europe and a new power relationship in the world. Failing this agreement on Germany, the United States had to make a far-reaching decision to fill the political vacuum, and this could only be done by restoring Western Europe to its former importance and to economic health. The answer is the Marshall Plan, which we owe to the unique initiative of our Secretary of State. The Marshall Plan is our supreme attempt to return to constructive peacemaking and to some of the ideals of the Atlantic Charter. It will mean sacrifice on our part. It will mean the acceptance of the full responsibilities of United States leadership of the free nations of the world. Good night.
The National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations, in cooperation with the American Historical Association, have presented Cesar Searchinger and the story behind the headlines. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.